the sea, somewhere waiting for me. My lover stands on golden sands and watches the ships that go sailing somewhere.
My gateway into the Marvel Universe, excluding the Hasbro-licensed G.I. Joe comics, was the X-Men. In 1991, I started collecting the Toy Biz X-Men action figures and comics whenever I could find them at the grocery store three blocks away. By 1992, I was riding my bike to comic book stores, yes, stores, plural, because in the 90s, there were four different venues for purchasing comics, each within bike riding distance. Initially, I collected X-Men, Uncanny X-Men, sometimes X-Force, and occasionally X-Factor and one of the Spider-Man books if it had a cool cover. For me, the wider Marvel universe of heroes and villains opened up not so much with comics, but with trading cards. Two different series of trading cards in 1992, actually. First was the Impel series with the Starscape background that linked 10 cards across and 10 down. The second set was the Skybox Marvel Masterpiece series, featuring painted portraits of heroes and villains, all by Joe Jusco. These cards were how I first discovered characters like Ant-Man and the Black Panther, and groups like the Guardians of the Galaxy. Speaking of which, how does Sylvester Stallone get cast in Guardians Volume 2 as Starhawk and not Vance Astro? Have you seen Vance when he became Major Victory? He's modeled after Rambo. Anyway, I didn't have complete sets of either series, but I had quite a few, maybe as many as two-thirds of each. The Impel cards had cool stats on the back that ranked each character's powers and abilities, while the Masterpieces had gorgeous painted art that was just a joy to look at. For instance, the Black Cat card from the Masterpieces set, I stared at her for a long time, night after night. The 1992 Marvel Masterpieces set is how I first discovered Namor, the Submariner. Even among the jaw-dropping paintings of Black Cat and Psylocke, even among those, the Namor card is attention-grabbing. It's a straight-ahead shot from about his waist up. His massive, muscled arms cross over his bare chest in defiance, and his face is hard as stone. He's not doing the Billy Idol sneer. His face is almost void of expression, and yet, you can absolutely read his face, and he's saying quite clearly, "F*** you." Of course, there are the other less natural physical attributes, the sharp Vulcan ears, the black hair with a widow's peak that would make Bela Lugosi jealous. And then there are the eyebrows. I know a lot of people look at Namor and they fixate on the little wings on his ankles, which are not visible on this card, by the way, or the fact that he's mostly naked much of the time, and yeah, I'll come back to that. But for me, the most striking thing about Namor has always been his eyebrows, these severe, unnatural eyebrows that completely change the shape of his face. They make him look all at once kingly and alien, which, I mean, I guess that's kind of the whole point. As best as I can recall, Namor the Submariner was the first character that I discovered through a trading card and then said, "I gotta know more about this guy. I want to read his comics." So at some point after that, I was at the comic store and decided to see if there was a Namor book on the shelf and buy it. Well, there was, and I did. But I don't think I kept the issue for very long. I don't even recall the exact number, but I know that it was during the era when Jay Lee was drawing Namor, and 4 out of 5 times I liked Jay Lee's artwork a whole lot. I liked him on X-Factor, I liked the unnatural angles and proportions, I loved the shadows and the deep blacks. I mean, I've said before that Gene Colan and Bernie Wrightson are two of my favorite artists, so yeah, I like art that lends itself to heavy inks and shadows. But Jay Lee's art on Namor wasn't doing it for me, which may have been because this was during the Savage Namor time period where he had long hair and a beard, and I think at the time I thought he looked like Naked Lobo. My mind sort of rejected this version of Namor because that's not what was on the card, and what I saw on the card was what attracted me to the character. Apropos, about a year later I tried to get into Aquaman after the Zero Hour event, but I dropped out after 2 issues into the Peter David run because his Aquaman changed and didn't look like the Super Friends version that I remembered. I tried reading the Namor comic again about a year later when Jeff Isherwood was drawing the book. That looked more classic, except Namor had a long ponytail. But my interest in that book didn't last. Another first occasion, Namor was probably the first superhero that I liked, despite not having read any good Namor stories up to that point. Today, that list of favored characters without cause is quite lengthy. I mentioned that Namor with long hair and a beard didn't seem right to me. The same should be said about Namor in any costume but Speedo trunks. That is what he wears, and that is all he wears. That's how I picture him. I have seen Namor in different costumes throughout the years, usually with black pants and some kind of vest. All of those costumes suck. That is not the real Namor. And you know, discovering this character in the early 90s and having to justify why I like him to my friends in middle school, that could be tough. I'm pretty sure all of them at some point said some variation of, "The dude is practically naked, what are you, gay?" At the time, I had no good comeback for that. Today, I would ask, would you put more clothes on Tarzan or Conan? Namor does not come from a civilization that we would recognize, nor one with our notions of modesty and repression. He doesn't need anything more than trunks because he doesn't. It's not in his environment. I didn't realize this when I was 11 or 12 years old, but Namor was the successor to the pulp adventure heroes that I had heard of even before the X-Men, Tarzan of the Jungle and Conan the Barbarian, and Namor the Submariner. And so, for about a decade, the Submariner was resigned to that corner of unrequited fandom, along with Ant-Man and Aquaman and the Bounty Hunters that nobody remembers, 4LOM and Zuckuss. I loved these guys, and yet, when asked why at any point in the 90s, I couldn't give you an answer. For Namor, at least, that changed in the mid-2000s. On a previous episode, I talked about how I fell in love with the Fantastic Four. Once I started collecting the essential volumes of the FF, I was thrilled to find Namor's first Silver Age appearance in Fantastic Four, Issue 4, and then his return appearances throughout the early 60s. I loved how Stan Lee and Jack Kirby depicted the character. The arrogance, the righteous anger, and the absolute power, the destructive capability, and the fact that he wanted Sue Storm was, you know, that was kind of cool too. I managed to get one of the Marvel Masterworks volumes of Namor's Golden Age stories from Submariner Comics in the 40s that were written and drawn by his creator, Bill Everett. I got this at a not unreasonable price. Unfortunately, the book was destroyed by my dog Lily when we first got her in 2012. She destroyed quite a few expensive books in the early days, including a collection of Dick Tracy newspaper strips published by IDW, and a big-ass hardcover black-and-white collection of the original Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, also by IDW, I believe. She chewed up my first edition copy of the novel Fight Club, she chewed up my wife's glasses. It was like she knew, she had a sense of what stuff would be the hardest to replace, and that is what she ripped to shreds. I'm glad she grew out of this before she found my long box of Secret Origins comics. Anyway, before we adopted Lily, when my wife and I first moved to her home state of Vermont back in 2009, I just had a part-time job initially, and not being from Vermont or New England, I used my free time to drive around a lot and explore the area and the surrounding towns. Really, I was just looking for comic stores. I discovered, to my horror, that there are only like 2 dedicated comic stores in the entire state, and they're both lacking in a lot of ways. There are a crapload of used bookstores and consignment shops, though, and sometimes you can find comics there. You run the risk of them being way overpriced, like $3 for what should be in the quarter bin, but every once in a while you find that issue of Action Comics that has the first appearance of Vixen for just 50 cents. There's a tiny little bookstore in Montpelier called The Book Garden I discovered early when I first moved out here. At the time, I went in because they had one of the volumes of Fables in their window display, and I think maybe the Holocaust graphic novel Mouse. I thought, hey, maybe they've got some other graphic novels or trades that are more to my taste. At the back of the store, they had a rack with maybe 30 discounted trade paperback collections, almost all Marvel. They had maybe 5 or 6 long boxes of comics on the floor beneath a table. The comics weren't sorted, they weren't bagged or boarded. It was a mess. But it was something, and I wanted to encourage them, so I got a comic. If you're still awake at this point, you probably guessed I bought a Namor comic. Finally, for the first time maybe, I was buying a comic with Submariner in the title, and the art looked really good. Classic, no long hair, no angsty goatee, no costume other than his green shorts. And he was fighting Dr. Doom on the cover, so jackpot? I go back to the store occasionally, maybe once a year, and I am happy to say that it has changed in 8 years. They have a lot of gaming supplies now, tabletop and role-playing stuff. They have a ton of HeroClix figures. They have maybe 5 whole shelves of graphic novels and trade paperbacks, and they have probably 30 long boxes, now arranged by $1, $2, or $3 comics. And they usually have a deal or promotion for them. It's a very encouraging sight for, still, such a tiny bookstore. Anyway, because I am an idiot, I finally got a great-looking Namor comic, and then I promptly didn't read it. Because in 2009 and 2010, whenever this was, I was hardcore into DC comics and characters. I wasn't reading anything by Marvel at the time. That would eventually change and swing back and forth for a while. Lately, I have been much heavier into Marvel and living almost entirely on Marvel Digital Unlimited. I have read so many comics on the Marvel Unlimited app this year. It's insane. I'll go through cycles where I'll binge big runs or binge on characters. Lately, I've been reading a ton of Namor the Submariner stories, everything from his Golden Age tales in Marvel Mystery Comics from 1939 to his Silver Age resurgence in Tales to Astonish and then Submariner up to the 1990 series by John Byrne. And at some point, I remembered that issue that I purchased from the Book Garden 8 years ago. And luckily, I had sorted it with some other books in storage, so Lily couldn't devour it. I promise you now, not every episode of Find Your Joy will be about a comic that I bought and then didn't read for a couple of years, and then did read it and decided it was the most amazing thing ever. This should be the last time that happens. Hopefully. Now I'm going to take a short break to play some promos. Come back after the break, and I'll tell you all about 1969's Submariner, issue 20.
Jeff and Merc present Unpacking the Power of Power Pack,
where we journey through each issue of the most underrated Marvel series of the 80s while drinking beer,
analyzing awesome and amazing adolescent adventures, and absorbing alcohol.
We got kids with powers, we got villains with attitude.
We got superhero guests, like all of them from the Marvel Universe.
We have thematically appropriate beer reviews.
We have good jokes and bad song parodies.
One stop for all your Power Pack pod-pleasing procurements.
And we got alliteration.
Find Unpacking the Power of Power Pack wherever fine podcasts are played.
Hi, I'm John Wilson.
And I'm Michael Kaiser.
And we're the hosts of the podcast Make Ours Marvel. You know, here we are in 2018, 10 years into the Marvel Cinematic Universe.
Yeah, can you believe we live in a world where everyone's old Aunt Petunia knows who Iron Man is?
It's crazy, right?
So, to celebrate, we're on our mission to explore the roots of the Marvel Universe.
You know, you've thought about it. Some of you may have even done it, and now we're going to do it too.
We're diving back into the long boxes of Marvel's history and podcasting our way through the whole universe.
All of it. Every superhero issue. And, if I can convince Mike, we'll even do Sergeant Fury.
And it's not going to be one issue per episode. That'd take forever.
It's still going to take forever.
But no, we're going to talk about as many comics as we can in an hour.
Yep, an hour and, you know, maybe a little change. Every week, Marvel Comics. So it'd be super cool if you came along for the ride.
Look for us every Friday at MakeOursMarvel.com.
That's MakeOursMarvel.com, or on iTunes and all the other usual podcasty places.
And if you want to read along with us and send us your thoughts, we might even read emails.
So until Avengers Infinity War gets a spin-off Warlock and the Infinity Watch TV show,
Make Ours Marvel.
Submariner 20 has a December cover date, but according to Mike's Amazing World of Comics, would have dropped on September 9th, 1969. The price tag was 15 cents. The cover, by John Buscema and Johnny Craig, shows Namor fighting Dr. Doom in an ornate-looking room with a knight's armor on display in the background, suggesting a castle or museum setting, maybe. There's a lot of falling rocky debris around Namor, like he's crashing through a wall or ceiling just out of view. There's a lot of energy and tension in their poses. And of course, it's the two best characters in all of comics right there squaring off against each other, so I love it. In the Darkness Dwells, Doom is written by Roy Thomas, penciled by John Buscema, who was filling in for Murray Severin, who was the regular artist on the book at this time, inked by Johnny Craig, lettered by Artie Simek, and edited by none other than Stan the Man Lee. The opening splash page shows Prince Namor hunkered down beneath a streetlight in New York, gritting his teeth, clenching his fist, and flexing every muscle in his arms, back, and shoulders. "Here, in the midst of the night-cloaked city that hates me," he says, "Namor is like an embattled beast at bay. Yet not for long shall I endure the slings and arrows of the surface men. The Submariner shall strike back." That is quite an opening, and it's impressive that Roy Thomas has Namor basically speaking the prose that Stan Lee would have put in captions. We quickly find out that Namor is in a bit of a bad spot right now. His gills have been closed up so that he can't breathe underwater, and his wings are sapped so that he can't fly. An editor's caption lets us know that an alien called Stalker did this to Namor back in issue 18. Since then, his general antisocial tendencies have been causing havoc in New York, and now there are Army or National Guard soldiers patrolling the streets looking for him. Hearing Namor monologue Hamlet-style in the street, a young boy comes to his window to see the Atlantean prince, only to lose his balance and plunge out the window. Namor is still fast and strong enough to catch the boy before he falls to his death. He puts the boy down and darts into an alleyway as the soldiers approach. They ask the kid where Namor went, and, thinking he might get his picture in the newspaper for cooperating with the Submariner's capture, the kid points them down the alley. Boy, that's kind of a shitty thing to do to the guy who just saved your life. When the squad of soldiers close in on him, Namor dives right into their midst and begins to fight the lot of them. He's strong enough that at first their bullets glance off him, but he's also been out of the water for a long time, and he's growing weaker by the second. He runs off down a side street and the soldiers pursue. The street dead ends at an iron gate outside a large townhouse. Namor tries to bend the bars of the gate in order to slip inside, but his strength is already failing. With no apparent escape, Namor turns back to face his pursuers. If he's going down, he's going down fighting. Just then, the gate swings open behind him. An unseen ally has taken note of Namor's predicament and allowed him inside. The gate then slams shut back in the faces of the soldiers. One of the younger grunts suggests that if they scale the wall and follow Namor inside, they can still catch him. His sergeant quickly shoots down that plan. Nobody will be following Namor now, not without causing a major international incident. For the townhouse Namor just entered is, in fact, the Latverian embassy. At the door, Namor is greeted by a voice that says, "Step forward, old friend, and enter my humble abode. It has been years since we last saw each other. Too many years." Unlike the soldiers, Namor doesn't know where he is. He vaguely recognizes the voice, but it's heavily modulated and not quite clear. The front door swings open, and as Namor steps into the lavish and ornate embassy, suddenly a hidden doorway opens up beneath the grand staircase. From the doorway, a metal machine rolls out on wheels. A laser cannon begins firing upon Namor. The Submariner dodges the laser blast, leaps forward, and catches the machine. He heaves it above his head and then slams it down where it explodes. For this uncanny display of strength and skill, Namor is applauded by the machine's master, the one and only Dr. Doom. The Monarch of Latveria tells Namor that the killer robot thing was just a test and plays it off like an assassination attempt is no big deal between former allies. He invites Namor to follow him through the embassy and offers him a drink while trying to convince the prince that they should work together. Namor is skeptical of Doom's motives, recalling the one time they did team up, back in Fantastic Four issue 6, Dr. Doom betrayed him and tried to kill him. He also refuses to drink with Doom, knocking the goblet of wine out of Doom's hand. All Namor craves is water to rejuvenate his dwindling power. Doom forgives the slight, telling Namor they should not let heated emotions get in the way of their common goal. What common goal, you may ask, and Namor definitely does ask. This time, it's Doom's turn to remind Namor of the events of Fantastic Four Annual No. 1, when Namor nearly conquered New York. Imagine, Doom tells him, what he could have accomplished if the Atlantean forces were bolstered by Doom's awesome technology. Even the Fantastic Four themselves would be brought low before the combined might of Namor and Doom. The Submariner rejects this offer of partnership, claiming he no longer seeks to wage war on the surface dwellers. The only thing Namor wants right now is some water. Dr. Doom says he will fetch some and leaves Namor alone in one of the rooms. When Namor is alone, he begins weighing his options for once he leaves the embassy. He is still hounded by the military. Where can he go? Namor's thoughts turn to Atlantis, and we take a little interlude to follow Triton of the Inhumans on a mission to the Sunken City. When Triton arrives, he informs Namor's beloved Lady Dorma of the Submariner's dire situation, and that Namor demands the Atlanteans not interfere or mount a rescue mission, as he wants no conflict between his people and the surface dwellers. This, understandably, makes Dorma upset. Back at the embassy, the Latverian ambassador tells Dr. Doom he cannot hold Namor hostage. Doom reminds the ambassador that nobody talks to him that way and threatens to kill him if he doesn't follow orders. Then the various Latverian officials go about the embassy, shutting off all of the water pipes and conduits, destroying the fire extinguishers, even emptying the ice trays so that there is not a single drop of water in the whole embassy. Doom returns to Namor and says he will only restore the life-giving water if Namor pledges to hand the Atlantean military over to Doom. Namor angrily refuses. "Then you have decreed your own fate," Doom says. "The Submariner must die." Namor attacks, but Doom's personal force field effortlessly knocks the prince to the ground. Doom suspects that Namor is actually weaker than he first thought, perhaps too weak to even be of any use. But Namor is still strong enough to push a giant stone statue off its pedestal and crash down on Doom. The Latverian's armor protects him, naturally, and summons a horde of mercenary thugs to defend their master. The men think Namor will be easy prey, and for that arrogance, the avenging son of Atlantis dishes out an epic ass-whooping. "Put your trust not in Dr. Doom, coward, but in the flailing fists of Namor the First." Namor considers taking the fight directly to Doom next, but opts instead to escape so he can rejuvenate himself with water and then return at full strength. But Doom has no intention of letting Namor escape. The Submariner heaves a heavy chair at the window, and though the glass does shatter, it only reveals more iron bars that Namor cannot bend. Doom presses a button, opening a panel in the ceiling, out of which descend three robotic tendrils, each tipped with a heat laser that blasts Namor. The heat blast dehydrates him all the quicker until he falls to his knees. Dr. Doom gives him one last chance to give the armies of Atlantis over to him, but Namor refuses, choosing death before surrender. When he collapses, a group of Latverian servants enter the room. Doom tells them to toss Namor in a cell until he can think of some other use for him. As the servants lift Namor, he springs with the last ounce of strength, grabs one of the robotic tendrils, and rips it open. The circuitry of the heat blaster sizzles, sparks, and ignites a massive fire. Doom orders his men to put out the fire, but they remind him that he ordered all of the water in the embassy shut off and the extinguishers dismantled. The fire spreads through the room. Namor lays on the floor near death, hoping his desperate gambit paid off. Doom curses himself and Namor, but his shouts are drowned out by the wail of sirens. A fire truck has arrived outside, and the firefighters hose down the embassy. A powerful stream of water sprays through the shattered window and showers down on the Submariner. The gush of life-restoring water refreshes Namor. His strength returned, the Prince of Atlantis takes one mighty leap, crashing through the roof of the embassy and out into the New York sky. Dr. Doom fumes in the wreckage of his embassy, now damaged by fire and water. Hey, that's the name of this podcast. For now, Namor has escaped one prison, but he's still trapped on the surface until he can find a way to get back to sea. And that is where Submariner number 20 ends. All right, No need to delay the obvious. This is my absolute favorite Namor story I have ever read, and by now I have read a ton of Namor stories. I have read a bunch of the Golden Age stories by Bill Everett, I have read a bunch by John Byrne, I have read a bunch by Stan Lee, Roy Thomas, Gene Colan, and Mary Severin. I really, really enjoy the Tales to Astonish stories that eventually became the Submariner series. I haven't read them all, but I've read a lot, and this issue is so, so good. Easily my favorite. Because I started collecting Marvel in the 90s and then went back to early Marvel in the 60s through their Essential volumes, because of that, I kind of missed John Buscema when he was at his best, so he flew under my radar until just a couple of years ago. I didn't really connect with him until I picked up a few Savage Sword of Conan magazines that he did, and then I could see how great he was at something like that. Then I saw his work on Thor, and then the Roger Stern Avengers run, and now John Buscema is one of my all-time favorites. His work on this issue with Johnny Craig is terrific. If you can draw an amazing Conan, you should be able to draw an amazing Namor, too. And he does. There are a couple of times when Buscema positions Namor so that he's standing on the balls of his feet and his legs are bent to form a sort of S shape. It looks so cool because, for one thing, there's a fluidity to the pose which makes you think of water and the Submariner, duh. But it also gives you the impression of a coil ready to spring. It makes Namor seem more animalistic, which I love. He also always draws the strain on Namor's face. He's constantly under pressure, but unlike in, say, the 90s, when image artists would draw people with clenched teeth for no reason, the strain is earned by the story. As for Dr. Doom, I think the brilliance of Doom's character design is that it's really hard for a good artist to make him look bad. I think, just like with Darth Vader, as long as you're true to the model, as long as you have the lines in the right place and the circles on the mask, the rest is fairly easy because the design does so much of the work for you. He just looks great. And yeah, Dr. Doom is my favorite Marvel supervillain, which is not a controversial statement, I know. Well, except maybe to Professor Allen, but I've already said that Reed Richards is my favorite hero, so the professor knows that we are mortal enemies. I think Roy Thomas does a fantastic, yes, that is a deliberate word choice, a fantastic job of writing Dr. Doom. When the ambassador tells him that he can't hold Namor prisoner, Doom says, "I did not appoint you ambassador so that you could dispute me, hireling. You exist but to obey my commands." He then grabs the man by his jacket lapels and looks like he's going to slam his head into a wall. "And obey them you shall," he continues, "without qualm or question, or an unmarked grave shall be your sole pension. Do you understand me?" But the biggest triumph is how he writes Namor. I think Roy absolutely nails the Submariner's voice. He's just so angry all the time, but it's a righteous and kind of noble anger. I mean, there's like 12 times in this comic when Namor is figuratively or literally backed into a corner staring down a beating or possibly death, and he's like, "Fine, fight me. You're not gonna get what you want." Even early in the story, he saves a little kid from falling to his death, and then when that brat narcs on him to the army, Namor says, "So, even one who is young can sting with the harsh whip of ingratitude." This is a Namor who is constantly ready for battle, constantly challenging everyone, but at the end, he still manages to save himself with some quick thinking and patience. You know, this is a short little interlude in the larger story of what's going on with Namor. It starts off with him having lost some of his powers. He doesn't have them back by the end, so this story is kind of inconsequential to the greater narrative. But as one solid issue, it's incredible, and it's mostly just a two-man show with two of my favorite characters. I love the dynamic between these two guys. Doom has absolutely no loyalty to Namor. If there's any kind of grudging respect for a fellow monarch, it's not strong enough that it would sway his emotions or actions. But Doom does think he can play on that commonality to earn Namor's trust. They share a socio-political station that few people on the planet understand, so he tries to use it to manipulate Namor. But Doom is almost kind of disgusted by Namor when he realizes how weak dehydration has made him. He's like, "Why have I wasted my time on you?" The thing is, this type of flattery and manipulation might work on some rulers, and could even work on Namor under different circumstances. But he's already amped up. He's already mad. He's been betrayed by Doom, so he's not trusting him again. He's also completely disinterested in Doom's pitch. Doom could have said anything. All Namor wants is, give me some water or get out of my way. Not gonna do that? Okay, we fight. It seems so obvious, but this is what I feel like comics used to be, and what they should be. We get a ton of action, and we get great characterization. If this was my first time meeting Namor and Dr. Doom, I would understand exactly who they are. Also, if this was my first Submariner comic, I would have been a lifelong fan reading the book month after month. I have gotten a lot of joy reading Namor stories over the years, and in particular recent months. But this story in particular, from Submariner issue 20, brings me so much joy that I just had to share it with you. If you can find this issue, I highly recommend giving it a read. For some reason, it's not on the Marvel Unlimited app, but it is on Comixology for just 99 cents. It was also reprinted in Giant Supervillain Team-Up number 1 and Essential Supervillain Team-Up Volume 1. That is all for this episode of Fire and Water Presents. As always, I want to thank everybody for tuning in. You can further support the show by liking and sharing on Facebook, favoriting or retweeting on Twitter, and leaving a comment on the website post at fireandwaterpodcast.com. Once more, thank you for listening, and find your joy. Imperious Rex! Right. Right is it done? Les noms des golfes clairs et des chansons d'amour, la mer, oh, a bercé mon cœur pour la vie.